Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. We're live worldwide on the award-winning Close Up Radio Live. A pleasure to have you with us today. Also a pleasure to welcome hospice advocate extraordinaire Judy Lund Herson. Judy is amazing. You know, Americans spend a lot of time avoiding and not thinking about death. It's not something they talk about. But like taxes, it is inevitable. And talking about where you'd like to be or who you'd like to be and what you'd like to do is essential entering this life stage with confidence and grace. As the former Vice President of Regulatory and Compliance at the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization and a longtime advocate for hospice services under Medicare, Judy Lund Herson has been working hard for more than 40 years to protect the definition of hospice care and to provide resources and guides for hospice providers to meet the Medicare requirements and provide high-quality hospice care. Many people think that hospice is a place. Other people think that hospice means that you will be required to die at home. The reality is that hospice is a service that providers offer wherever the patient is. Hospice care is provided by an interdisciplinary team, including nurses, physicians, social workers, chaplains, aides, and other people who might be needed. There's music therapy, there's massage. The team works together to develop a plan just for the patient and their family. And the patient and the patient's chosen family are all receiving care from the hospice team and support for physical symptoms, psychosocial, as well as spiritual concerns, and that comes for both the patient and the family. After the patient's passing, bereavement support is available to the family for up to 13 months to help with adjustments to the loss of their loved one. We know this personally because we lost an uncle, and they used hospice. The uncle wanted to pass at home, and at first they weren't necessarily comfortable with having people come in their house. They were older. However, they got comfortable with it, used it, and our aunt speaks so highly of it, and so do we. And they did come for about 13 months after checking on her to make sure that she has everything she needed to get through the loss of her husband, our uncle. So we can tell you firsthand the incredible compassion and empathy and skillful work that hospice does. Since leaving NHPCO, she has founded Lund Herson & Associates Hospice Consulting for hospice providers looking for resources and expert guidance. A lot of times the caretakers themselves are often forgotten about, and they need care as well. She's a real advocate for all of the above. We're very honored to welcome Judy coming to us from Ashburn, Virginia, USA, for part one of our exclusive two-part series here on Close Up Radio Live. Judy, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Jim.
You are very, very welcome. You're an educated and passionate speaker, and I know you like to share your hospice experiences, both personal and as a regulator, and to answer any questions about hospice and end-of-life care. You've spent your life working to help make hospice a peaceful experience for everybody. Tell us about your experiences, maybe even as a child, as that was a nexus for your passion.
Well, I've often kind of gone back and thought about why in the world did I get into hospice? And I think, you know, certainly one of the big reasons is when I was 12 years old, the summer between sixth and seventh grade, my father died suddenly of a heart attack in the night. And I have two younger sisters. At that time, they were 9 and 7. And we didn't have any support whatsoever when we were dealing with the loss of our dad. And My mom was devastated, of course. He was only 42, so we were a young family, and we struggled to try and figure out how to kind of move on. And I think each of us, my sisters and I, and certainly my mom, we handled it in our own way, but we did not really have help for that. And so early on, I said, there has got to be some way to support children who have lost a parent. And, you know, I would look around at friends in my class, and no one else had lost a parent. So it was a very lonely, lonely time. So that I think, set me on my course to try and figure out how we can do that much better than I experienced.
Even after that experience, you didn't really necessarily plan on working with hospice. When you graduated, you began your career working with the state of North Carolina, creating volunteer programs at governmental agencies, health departments, state psychiatric hospitals, and facilities for those with intellectual disabilities. How did hospice come your way?
Well, it is kind of, I guess now, a sort of famous story that I was traveling for the state government of North Carolina. I was on a flight to, I think, Chicago. And I was living in Raleigh, North Carolina at the time, and sat down in a middle seat, much to the chagrin of the man who was sitting at the window. And the woman who was sitting on the aisle had never flown before, and she was terrified. And so, you know, I have training as a social worker, so I'm, you know, I see that she's terrified, and I said, you know, it really is going to be okay, and she was flying to see her son in Las Vegas and all of that. So I turned to the man at the window, and I said, please help me reassure our seatmate that she will be okay. And he turns to her and says, you'll be okay, and turns back to his papers. About midway through the flight, we started talking about where he was going and what I was doing. And he said he was going to one of the first meetings of the National Hospice Organization Standards Committee. And he said, you know, my job is to bring the job descriptions of all the members of the interdisciplinary team, and the only one I don't know what they do is a volunteer coordinator. And I said, well, you know, it so happens that's what I do in state government. So, you know, this is before the internet, before email, before everything was lightning fast. And so I said, when I get back to the office, I'll send you some information, but here's what you can take with you to this meeting. And so we kept in touch, and he was the chair of the board of Hospice of North Carolina, which was originally designed to be just like the Connecticut Hospice, one hospice for the state of North Carolina. And in the first meeting, 75 people came, and they said, oh, no, 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 no. We do not want one hospice. We all want our own hospices. And so Hospice of North Carolina became an organization that's helped hospice providers get started in the state of North Carolina. So, you know, and I was on the board, and then I was hired as their executive director. I was young. I was really, really young. And, you know, I drove around the state and talked to community groups about here's what you do to get hospice going. And, you know, even more miraculous, there was no reimbursement at all for hospice care. It was all raise money in the community, hire one person. All the other work was done by volunteers. So it's a very unusual beginning to what we now have as a Medicare hospice benefit.
It's extraordinary. Really, really is. Tell us what historical events sort of demonstrate how important hospice is for patients and for families.
Well, I think if we are kind of thinking back, and I certainly think back often to the times before there was hospice, and patients were dying in the hospital, often they were at the end of the hall. Nursing staff, other staff in the hospital didn't want to go in their rooms, so they didn't. And so the patient died alone, often in tremendous pain, and it was a very, very difficult passing for many, many patients. Family members maybe wouldn't even visit, but if they did, they saw their loved one in pain and agony. And I think the early advocates of hospice said there has got to be a better way for us to treat people at the end of life. So probably at the very beginning of all of this, one of my most important moments is to think about all those people that helped hospices get started all over the country. Before there was Medicare money, before there was anything besides people with passion.
That's incredible. Really, really is. Maybe you can even share some details about, you know, as I mentioned off-air with you, and then even in the introduction, our family has used hospice for an uncle that had passed and wanted to pass at home. And we can't say enough about how hospice, you know, treated the family and how they took care of all the needs and then followed up after. And just interactions I've had with nurses who work in hospice, I've visited hospice personally. It's very loving and empathetic, compassionate. In a way, you almost wonder how do those people go into work every day knowing that they're is more than likely the chance that, you know, Gloria, who's in room 22, isn't going to be there maybe tomorrow. Maybe you can share some details about how it works. And also, I'd love to know how you emotionally do the work. How do you do the work where you're going into a situation knowing that there isn't really necessarily an out for the people that are there. It's to provide the comfort and the care and things of that nature. How do you emotionally deal with that? It's not, you don't become numb. It's a question I've always asked people that do this kind of work and people that work in hospitals and EMTs, firefighters, police officers, first responders. How do they do it and do it again and again and again?
So maybe just to start with what hospice is, and that is a program of care, providing care to a patient who has a life expectancy of 6 months or less if the disease follows its normal course. And it is provided wherever the patient is. So if you've got a loved one who's in a nursing home or in an assisted living, the hospice will go there. If you have a patient, I was volunteer for a patient who had young children, and his decision as he was getting to the end of his life was, I can't die at home. I can't, I have to make sure that my children don't see the end of my life this way. So he wanted very much to go to the hospital to die, and that is a choice that every patient and family can make. What are your, we call it advanced care planning. What are the things that you want to make sure are taken care of, or who is going to make decisions if you can't make them any longer? A lot of those kinds of concerns are very much a part of the hospice's work. You know, I also, I think about how this works for, how this has worked in my own life. I had a neighbor who was like a second dad to me. His name was Bill. And he got a diagnosis of advanced lung cancer after many, many years of smoking. And the doctor told him he had, you know, maybe 3 months to live. And so, you know, he wasn't my dad. He was a neighbor. But we said to him, another neighbor and I and my husband said, we'll do whatever you want, Bill. And he wanted to go out to eat every single night. Now, we should be clear that the high end of his restaurant choices was Denny's. So imagine what is not Denny's. It's Denny's and everything beyond beyond that. So, you know, we had to do a little weight loss going into after his death, for sure. But you know, I think the most incredible part of it, he was a Korean War veteran. And the hospice team came and the chaplain came. And he had talked to the primary nurse and said, what is God going to think of me because I went behind enemy lines in Korea? I'm worried that God will not accept me. And so the spiritual care part of his journey was very, very important. And the work of the chaplain with him privately was very, very, very helpful to his peaceful passing at the end of life. And, you know, I think if we think about that, and I don't work directly with patients and families, except when it's my family or except as a volunteer. But I think if we think about what we would want if it was us, and I'm always thinking about that. It's like the patient, whoever that patient is, and their family, biological or chosen families, that's what we care about. And it is not just the patient. It's the patient and their family. So sometimes it is spending time with the wife or the husband, and having a volunteer come in so that the wife or husband can go to the grocery store, can go, you know, take a walk, can do any kind of things that, you know, might help them, you know, get a break or get some rest or whatever. So, you know, I think all of that is really a huge part of it. But it's all based on, just like you said at the very beginning, a individualized plan of care that every single patient has. And that plan of care is developed by the nurse, the doctor, the social worker, the chaplain, the aide, everybody who might be involved with that particular case. And they all have talked to the patient, they've talked to the family, and they say, okay, how do we make it the very best we can be for this particular patient and their family?
So incredibly important. It really, really is. It's beautiful work that you do. And what are some of the additional things people can expect if they are considering hospice? And what are some of the misconceptions? Like they think it's a place, or they think it can only be done at home. There's a lot of different things as well that people realize what it actually is and the incredible services it offers. I think it will enlighten them.
Right. I think, you know, definitely it could be a place, but that's not where most of the care is provided. So most of the care is provided to patients in their own homes, or what we usually say, in their own homes, or whatever they call home. So nursing home, assisted living, box on the street. And yes, we do provide hospice care to homeless individuals as well. So just really trying to be as open and accepting of whatever the patient's circumstances are, and provide care no matter what. So I think that's the first thing. And, you know, I 100,000 times I have talked to groups and to patients and families about, yes, hospice is a place sometimes, but that's not really what we do. It's really bringing the care to you wherever you are. And I think that's a really, really important piece of it. So, you know, in the case of my own mother, who was a hospice patient just for a short time, about 7 days, the hospice brought both music therapy and massage therapy to her in her assisted living facility, and very, very wonderful benefit for her for both of those things, which were completely designed for her and her needs and our family's needs. So, you know, I think if we think about what would be the best we can hope for, the best we can hope for is to be as, to have our symptoms managed, especially pain. But also shortness of breath and other very distressing symptoms. And we would never say we can completely get rid of them, but we want them to have the skills and abilities of our medical teams to help them with managing those symptoms so they're tolerable. So sometimes a patient will say, I don't care what you do, doctor, but I want to live, and this is true, I want to live until my cousin, my grandson, graduates from high school. And maybe that's 2 weeks away, and so we are, you know, working hard to make sure that that patient can meet that life goal, meet that goal with what they want to do with the time they have left. And, you know, sometimes it is, care that needs to be more, hospice would not be in the home 24/7 for sure. But sometimes if there is an acute symptom management issue and it can be managed at home, the nurse and the aide can both come to the home for an extended period. And that really helps that symptom get back under control. And, you know, I think the many, many people that I talk to who've had a hospice experience are very grateful for symptom management skills of the professional hospice team. So, you know, I'm proud of that, and I'm very proud that we are looking at the whole person, not just the physical symptoms.
It's so extraordinarily important, the whole person, and it's a beautiful thing. Tell us about hospice consulting. Are there specific clients? Are there ideal clients? Is it everybody, anybody?
Well, in my work, I'm really working with hospice providers and with hospice state organizations. It is very policy heavy. So if we're looking at what do the regulations say, are there new regulations coming out that we need to pay attention to? And how do we make sure that we are meeting those regulations? So that is really heavily my and has been my work for the last 20 years or so. But also to think about what changes could we make that would make the patient experience, the family experience better. Are there things that the hospice could do differently so that the patient has the best possible experience? We are collecting data from the family after the patient has died. It's called the CAHPS Hospice Survey. And so we're hopeful that families will tell us if we've done well or if we have areas for improvement. And, you know, both things are very, very important to the hospice provider. So I think, you know, those are some of the things we're looking at. Quality. How did the hospice do when, how many times did the nurse visit? How often did the nurse visit? The norm normally would be around once a week. But sometimes if the plan of care dictates it, you would see the nurse more often. You'll have a way to call if there's an emergency. You can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in order to get some advice or to have a nurse come out and visit. So I think all of those things are part of what the hospice can provide, and your listeners, I think, will be able to ask questions of a hospice they might be talking to say, do you provide nursing visits 24/7? That would be a really important question, I think, to ask. And also, who do you contract with if my loved one needs hospital care? Because hospice is required to work to coordinate that as well. So what hospitals in the area do you contract with? Other questions about how often does your nurse visit? When can I expect an aid visit? All of those are really important questions if you're looking for a hospice.
Very important. Why do you love doing this work so much?
I think, and people have asked me this a lot, especially because my whole focus has been on the regulatory side. I love to be able to connect the dots. So when we say a new regulation comes out that says, and we're working on one right now that says the medical director, the language in the regulation says the medical director does da-da-da, you know, and it's the, what the medical director does is not as important as the change that we're hoping to see in the next few days. The medical director or the physician designee. So it's there is one medical director for the hospice, but there could be a lot of physicians working for the hospice, either part-time or full-time. We want anybody who is a physician working for the hospice to be able to make some determinations that have been reserved only for the medical director and have been very difficult to fulfill. So that would be just one example of something that is a tiny, you know, three words added to the regulations, but it's going to make a huge difference for providers and will enable any physician who's working for the hospice to have a part of the decision making according to the regulations. So it is, I know, very weedy, so my apologies for that.
You know, having conversations about end-of-life wishes before a crisis really is important to families, right? Write them down. Choose
Absolutely.
Someone you trust who can make decisions on behalf if you can't.
Absolutely.
We can all start by talking with family members and just getting things underway
right.
So it's easier when it happens, right?
Right, absolutely. What we always say is if you can have a conversation with your family before any crisis happens, you will know a lot more about what your family member wants. And all of us should be deciding that. You know, there are some people who say you should have a conversation about what you want at the end of life over Thanksgiving dinner. Or you should National Healthcare Decisions Day, the day after taxes are due on April the 16th. Any and all of those things are good ways to have a beginning conversation. For me, I began having a conversation with my mother, who did not want to talk about this at all. And so we were visiting the funeral home where her oldest brother had just died. And we're standing in line waiting to talk to the family. And I said to her, okay, Mom, what about this do you like? And she was a little bit startled, but she wasn't thinking about it in terms of what she wanted for herself when she died. But she said, oh, Judy, I want lots of flowers. Okay, got it. That was, you know, and so sometimes the opportunity presents itself in the most unusual way. But we were able to honor that wish of hers after she died.
That's beautiful. It really is. And again, that comes into play with some of the extraordinary work that is available and the compassion and the empathy that goes with it. I encourage folks to go to the website, hospiceconsultant.com. Hospice is spelled H-O-S-P-I-C-E, in case you needed to know that, hospice, and then the word consultant.com to connect with Judy of Lund Person and Associates Hospice Consulting. Judy, it's beautiful work you do, and thanks for sharing it with us. This is part one of a two-part series. Judy will be back at 3 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, August 7th, so we invite you to tune in for part two as well. I really appreciate all that you do and honor you for what you do, and I know it comes from your heart and soul, Judy, and I hope we get a chance also to chat some more down the line. It would be a pleasure. And I also hope you enjoyed the time with me as much as I have with you today.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure to be with you.
You are very, very welcome. And again, part two coming up next week, so stay tuned for that, folks. This is your host, Jim Masters, where you thank hospice advocate Judy Lundperson. Go to hospiceconsultant.com to learn more. And we also thank you for joining us here worldwide on Close Up Radio Live. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with another incredible guest celebrated from around the world right here on the program. Till then, for all of us, have a great day. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.